It's a bird. It's a plane. It's oh my, it's the National Security Law Podcast. It's back. Hello from Austin and welcome to the first episode of this show in a very, very long time. It's episode 245 and we're brought to you by the Strauss Center at the University of Texas. It's April Fool's Day, and yet this is actually
real.
Real. It's happening. I'm Bobby Chesney.
I'm Steve Vladek. So Bobby, I went and looked. Do you know how long it's been since our last episode?
Well, it's been like 3 or 4 weeks, 6 weeks.
100 days. Oh my God. Literally, like to the day. Like,
wait, really? It's
been exactly 100 days.
It's our centennial of doing other things.
It's our quarterly episode.
Oh my Lord. Lots of love and thanks to all of y'all who've been reaching out and asking
when the heck is this podcast coming back?
And
we're back.
We're back. Oh man. Well, we are back and we're delighted to be back. Apologies. Things been busy for both of us.
Couple things happening.
Big news. I bet there's not a person who listens to the show that does not know your big news, but as much as it breaks my heart to hear about it again, I nonetheless invite you to share it with the audience.
Karen and I actually found someone the other day who had not heard. Karen and
what grade was that person in?
They were a work friend of Karen's.
All right.
and a fellow parent at the girls' school.
Oh man.
So the Vladeks are moving back to DC as of the end of this academic year. I'm going to go take a position at Georgetown, a law school some of you may have heard of that, you know, is also in Washington. I talked about this a bit when we told folks about a month ago, but I mean, it really is very much not about Georgetown versus UT and very much about the chance for the girls to be closer to our families, closer to, you know, our friend network in DC. No one's getting younger. The opportunity to be sort of back on the Amtrak corridor was one that we just weren't in a position to pass up.
You know, I'd be the biggest hypocrite in the world if I questioned that, because there was that time in 2008 when I was at Wake Forest, which I loved so much, and the people there are as amazing as faculty could possibly be. By the way, if you're, you know, a student looking at Wake Forest, you know, you're in for a treat. It's a wonderful place. But my family and Heather's family, they're all here. And so, same deal. And I appreciate and respect so much, and actually really as much as I'm losing out on it, and the school's losing out on, we're all super bummed you're leaving, but you're,
I don't know if you're all super bummed.
I think actually the level I can tell you, cause I now am in the business of traveling around talking to people all the time and everybody's super bummed. But we're all happy for you. We're excited for your as a family matter. We're very happy for you.
That's I appreciate that. I think there might be some how do I put this delicately, folks with lifetime commissions who may not be so brokenhearted at me not being in Texas anymore.
Well, something tells me that you're going to be no less visible to anyone who's not
they have internet in Washington. But as relevant to this, we should also say that we have no plans to sort of put the podcast away.
On the contrary, judging by our centennial episode here, the odds are extremely good that we'll do better than we've been doing.
Well, so if we're no longer in the same building, we might actually have to do something crazy like schedule a regular recording window.
Do you have to have an AI to do that?
I have been pushing Bobby to put a regular recording window onto our schedules for, 4 years now. And one of these days it's going to happen.
Well, we really should do that. I have some recurring meetings that I can enforce. And so we just need to, we will fold this in.
Yeah. I'll just be one of your recurring meetings.
By the way, did you watch Schitt's Creek? Are you a Schitt's Creek fan?
So at least by osmosis, because Karen's obsessed with it.
Okay, so first of all, you should probably just hang up from this call and go watch it because it's brilliant.
I think our listeners want more than a 5-minute episode.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I don't think it really checks the box if we.
Bye, everybody.
I'll just say for those who are aficionados, whenever I hear the phrase "fold it in," you just fold it in. That is a highly relevant reference.
Okay, so even I who didn't watch Schitt's Creek that carefully, get that reference.
All right, so yeah, we're going to keep the show going, absolutely. And, you know, I really actually think we probably will get back to a more regular.
I suspect it's likely.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you've got a move to deal with. And anybody who's ever done a move knows it's a huge life disruptor, lots of ramifications. So you got that going on. You know, for my part, I think as time goes by, the dean life gets a little more settled and regimented. There are aspects of this that are novel every day. But there's also a lot that's like teaching a course. First time through, as every teacher knows, first time through is insane how much time you have to put into it to figure out how certain recurring moves work. Second time through is, you know, dramatically more efficient, and it gets better like that. So I think we can make it work.
I have faith.
Well, here's a question, Steve, though. Is there going to be anything to talk about?
No, I mean, obviously nothing is happening in field relevant to our work.
Indeed. The field keeps stretching its boundaries.
I mean, Bobby, we're putting out a new edition of our national security law casebook this summer. And, you know, this is a statement against interest, but it's already out of date and it hasn't even gone to press yet.
I mean, my e-casebook on cybersecurity, which badly needs to be touched up, same deal, right? Like certain fields, and you and I have been, for better or worse, both committed to a variety of cognate fields. That what I think part of what both of us love so much about them, whether it's Fed courts, con law, cybersecurity, national security law, counterterrorism, whatever, these are not static fields. They are constantly changing. And it's exhausting to teach and write in those areas, but it's also awesome. So if you're an aspiring academic in pondering fields, I think I speak for both of us when I say choose something that's going to be evolving and relevant and, yes, also be prepared for lots
or
of
not. Or be, you know, the leading expert on 17th century, you know, English tort law. And then, you know, nothing ever changes.
There are days when I think the legal historians have it right.
Oh my gosh. I mean, there are days where I wish I just was a legal historian.
Well, you kind of are.
I mean, amateur.
Well, serious question. Would you consider yourself a legal historian? There's a lot of history in some of your work.
Yes, but I know enough about the sort of the craft of history to not claim to be a professional historian.
Disciplinary respect on display.
Well, I mean, right. I mean, I think what I'm interested in is sort of constitutional history, right, and institutional history, which is, you know, relevant. But it's not sort of telling the stories of themselves that motivate me so much as using the stories to illustrate, you know, sort of broader theses.
Right. I think you and I would both agree that both for teaching purposes and in our research, rare is the circumstance, unless you're talking about something that's basically happening now, which a lot of times you and I are focused on.
Yep.
But when we're teaching or writing about developments in the past in terms of the formal law, that is statutes, executive orders, court decisions. I think we both think you've got to situate it in a rich historical context to make sense of it.
Agree. So I am, among lots of other things, because I have nothing better to do right now. I'm working on a new book proposal.
is this going to be in line? I don't know if you can talk about it. Can you talk about it?
A little. I mean, it's going to be sort of, it is in some respects a bit of a sequel to the Shadow Docket. So I'm putting the 1864 project a bit to the side for the moment.
Oh, okay. That's where I was getting at. Yeah. I was looking forward to the 1864
project. It's coming.
I can feel that your publisher has gotten to you.
Well, and also I think I've yet to be persuaded that there's a whole book as opposed to like a long form essay on 1864. But anyway, but so the story that I'm sort of using to introduce the proposal for the sequel-ish book is the story of Ex Parte McCardle. Basically the sort of the three-way battle between Congress, Andrew Johnson, and the Supreme Court over Reconstruction.
Okay. Well, this is obviously, you know, you're near 1864. I can handle that if you're going to go Reconstruction.
Right. It's 1868. It's just 4 years later.
Absolutely. There's a little bit going on at that time.
It's crazy, man. I mean, there's a single day in March 1868 where Salmon Chase, who at this point is the Chief Justice, right, spends the morning presiding over the fourth day of oral arguments in McCardle, and then literally like walks, you know, 150 paces from the old Senate chamber to the new Senate chamber to begin the impeachment trial of President Andrew Johnson.
Amazing. This would make for a good HBO miniseries.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, Reconstruction as a miniseries would be really interesting. Oh, 100%.
Actually, that it deserves, you know, the novel of our times is long form, high end TV. And so a really serious treatment would be really cool.
I mean, you could use Eric Foner's book as the model.
I hope somebody's listening and they could, Steve.
Hey, Ken Burns. Okay, I missed my chance. All right. So I gave a talk at Tulane University last Monday. And after the talk, they took me out to a really nice dinner at Commander's Palace. You know, always famous.
Fun. Hope you brought
classic,
your jacket.
Right? And you know, we sit down at this table in the corner and we look over casually, and at the table next to us is Ken Burns.
Oh, no way. That's awesome. Well, but of course, he seems like he would be at Commander's Palace.
So I missed my chance to pitch him on, you know, Reconstruction, a film by Ken Burns.
No. Well, you're just going to have to do it yourself. Is it too late to negotiate that somehow into your Georgetown contract?
Oh, my Georgetown contract.
I got an unusual request for you.
Hire Bobby
told me they could do it at UT if I stayed, so you got to match this.
All right. Anyway, should we talk about like actual national security law stuff?
Yeah, I guess so. Okay. So what's on our agenda?
So here's what I have a list, and I think we're going to not be able to give any of these topics the time they're due, but we can do maybe a sort of a mini lightning round for each. So we have all of the continuing horrific things that are happening in Gaza and Israel, okay. And the latest developments in the United Nations. We have, you know, ongoing developments in Russia and Ukraine. We have the very strange but true fate of Section 702, which is still up for reauthorization sometime
tick
soon.
TikTok, TikTok, that's good.
We also have TikTok, which we have. I didn't put TikTok in the run of show, but I guess we should. I guess TikTok is also in here somewhere.
Well, those two pair nicely. Like a meal and a wine.
Indeed.
As legislation that is this moving? Is this not moving? What are we doing here?
Trump litigation. There's been some of that.
Yes. Yeah, there
have. You know, we don't usually talk a lot about immigration law, but in the context of the ongoing fights between Texas and the Biden administration, there has been now this sort of litigation of the question of what does it mean to be under invasion for constitutional purposes?
Yeah,
and, you know, do states have this, what Texas calls Article 1 constitutional self-defense power? Which has lots of national security.
This checks a lot of boxes for us.
Checks a lot of boxes. Yeah, most of them frustrating. And then we have for frivolity, you know, given that the Mets are already 0-3, you know, what are we going to do with all the time that will be freed up by not watching them this season?
Awesome. All right.
By the way, not only are they 0-3, Bobby, they're in the 9th inning right now of game 4. They haven't scored.
I know. Why would... Why break a streak?
I mean, the only good news is, at least so far, neither have the Tigers, but... that's not true. The other good news is, you know, the Astros are also 0-4, so, you know.
I think they were, last time I checked, I think they were winning tonight, though.
Oh, mayonnaise. All right. Well, yes.
Did you say mayonnaise?
I do think this is our new thing with the girls. It's like, oh, mayonnaise as a very generic way of saying, you know, things that are otherwise not so polite.
Oh, that's funny. Okay. Why don't we, let's begin our journey around the world abroad with the twin conflicts. We've got Israel, Hamas, the larger theater. We should probably extend beyond just Israel, Gaza, Hamas. Yep. And then we'll talk, Russia and Ukraine. Obviously, we could talk for more
hours.
Than an hour about the substance and the politics and all that stuff. But from a national security law perspective, we've talked in the past, and I guess I have to hear say, like last year when we last recorded, we had many episodes touching on various issues, including all the very important IHL or law of armed conflict issues involving how force is being used in theater. The newer development that I think you were adverting to earlier, are you talking about the resolution? Is that what was on your mind?
Yeah.
So and lay that out for the people. What's going on with the resolution?
Well, so, you know, I mean, this is a matter of some debate unto itself, but after some, you know, very, very messy negotiating and a couple of negative votes by the United States, which of course has a permanent veto on the Security Council, the Security Council finally last week passed a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire, at least for the month of Ramadan, the holy, you know, Islamic month of Ramadan, the immediate and unconditional release of hostages, and the urgent need to expand the flow of aid into Gaza. And the United States did not vote in support of the resolution, but it also did not veto it. The United States abstained. That we didn't veto?
Yeah.
I mean, so I think, Bobby, I mean, a lot has happened since last we recorded. I do think that slower than I would have liked, the Biden administration is coming around to the view that it can't just keep giving Israel a blank check. And I think it's, you know, it's caught between a rock and a hard place for lots of reasons that I think are both obvious and otherwise. But I think we're starting to see, you know, tougher talk from the administration about Israel's continuing, to my mind, you know, excessive uses of force in Gaza. You know, this effort to build a pier to facilitate the distribution of aid into Gaza. You know, I see these all as being of a piece. Of the Biden administration, you know, sort of turning a slightly stronger, not just rhetorical, but policy, you know, a thrust, right, toward the Israeli government.
They are certainly, for them, they're between a rock and a hard place. The electoral politics over, I mean, it's an election year, and it looks to me, I'm no expert in this sort of thing, but it sure looks to me like part of what's going on is this growing appreciation that there's a level of political friction and possible impacts on turnout levels in some key places that make it, just as a political matter, very untenable for them to carry on as they were. But also on the policy side, seems pretty obvious there's a real division of opinion within various parts of the administration. You get little insights and glimpses into this. That's no real surprise. It is interesting though. I mean, it's a big deal for there to be a resolution like that the United States doesn't veto.
Yeah,
it also is pretty symbolic. Neither Hamas nor Israel is, you know, going to respond to this.
Right. But I mean, so I guess I don't think it's quite so cynically. I mean, yes, there's obviously electoral calculus that's going into some of this. You know, I guess I'm inclined to give at least a little bit of the benefit of the doubt to the executive branch here, that I think it's also, as time has gone on, the Israeli government's unwillingness to brook any kind of moderation has been, I think, harder and harder to defend. Certainly, I mean, I have found it increasingly difficult to justify or stomach. And I say this as someone who wasn't especially a fan of Netanyahu to begin with. So I guess, yes, I think there was political pressure to do this, but I also think that even those who were telling themselves a story that was more deferential to the Israeli government, say in November and December and even January, you know, just looking at what's happening on the ground, I think it's easy to understand why that story has changed.
It's really the key thing is what's going to happen now in Rafah, right?
Yep.
And I don't see how the Netanyahu administration steps back while there's still a substantial degree of Hamas command and control and fighting force in place. And so, to my mind, I think it's probably, I mean, maybe there could be enough domestic pushback there. I don't know what the politics are domestically there. Maybe they find it untenable. I think it's more likely that one way or the other, the further incursion into that sort of last substantial bastion is going to go forward. And what could be modulated is the means and methods of how that unfolds.
But I mean, you know, maybe also part of it is just, you know, mechanisms to potentially bring down the Netanyahu government and replace it with a government that is, you know, willing to accept some kind of compromise at this point.
I don't know. You know, I know nothing about how I have a tendency to think like what our experience after 9/11 was very different, extremely different. We didn't get into this kind of fighting until after the invasion of Iraq and the rise of the insurgency and situations like Mosul. But we did have some situations like that in Iraq. And I think, you know, if you look at some of the civilian casualty, the U.S. government attributed figures on that, you could make some somewhat similar arguments against us. And I don't think we wouldn't have, I'm sure many people did at the time. And I don't think we gave it much heed in the population. Certainly the United States wasn't really engaged at all. It seems very different with Israel today, where the whole thing from the start has been a matter of urban or near urban warfare and has much more attention. I don't think it's quite analogous in terms of the political impact of it all. And so whether that creates more pushback and friction, I don't know. I mean, certainly one takeaway here is urban fighting in the modern period. I think everyone can agree. Urban fighting for rule of law societies in the modern period is extremely fraught because there is bound to be a huge civilian impact. And you may have circumstances, arguably is what the U.S. had in Iraq at the stage I was just mentioning, where it just feels far enough away and there's enough sort of perceived distance and limits to the media coverage in terms of what they're emphasizing that it doesn't boil over. But the Israel scenario right now and the Rafah scenario and the plight of the Gazans, it's very different, I think.
Yes. And unsustainable. And, you know, I mean, I you know, it is a moral tragedy that, you know, I think the Biden administration is increasingly trying to figure out how to extricate itself from. And that may be overdue. It may be belated. You know, they may have very limited options, but, you know, I think there's at least something to be said for not just burying your head in the sand.
We'll see what they do. I mean, it's such a devilish situation because, of course, Hamas bears so much of the responsibility yep. for this. I mean, so much of this is by design, intended.
Yep.
So, okay. Now, there's more to the theater of conflict because, you know, the Houthis, the use of force, the obvious and direct and similar to Hamas, just targeting civilian objects as if no big deal. And the impact on the sea traffic is ongoing. I haven't heard anything of late about U.S. uses of force within Yemen in response to this. We had a flurry of that at some point during the past 100 days.
I was going to say, we saw a bunch, we saw like a week or two where there was really seemingly almost an escalation.
I think that the United States and allies who are involved in what could be described as the Shipping Protection Coalition was well within its rights using force as it did in response to these attacks on shipping. I guess if we could run through a UN Charter analysis,
you could.
You know,
but I mean, what's interesting to me, Bobby, is that what seemed like it was ramping up has since seemed to die down. Is that, I mean,
when you're fighting in an asymmetric situation, there can be a paucity of targets.
Yeah.
There's also a really bad budgetary trade-off between what it costs to fire the missiles Iran is providing to the Houthis, which then are, you know, being fired, or, you know, the drones, et cetera, all the things that the Houthis are using, price point wise, it's very small compared to the cost of the weaponry the United States and others need to deploy both to shoot things down that are incoming and U.S. strikes back.
Yep.
So maybe that's overhanging as well. But I think the biggest problem is it's hard to find targets.
Yeah. I mean, this is the one advantage of recording every 100 days, right? Is that, you know, so there was a civil war and then it ended. So now we can talk about it.
Take a retrospective, you know, on that. Well, you know, the one thing, so I said a minute ago, you could do a UN Charter analysis. Is the United States infringing, you know, Yemeni sovereignty by, you know, first of all, I don't know what the state, well, I don't know what L at the State Department takes a position on who is the repository and holder of Yemeni sovereignty right now. But setting aside consent issues, this would be the longstanding U.S. position of presidents of both parties at this point, going on 2 decades, is there's an unwilling, unable concept that is an alternative pathway that seems very, very paradigmatically applicable to what the Houthis are doing when they're firing an avalanche of rockets at shipping in the Red Sea. Interestingly, on that same ground, I saw a story, I don't know if the provenance was reliable or not, but I saw a story suggesting that Pakistan had launched a cross-border strike against targets in Afghanistan after, in an ironic situation, maybe not ironic, but possibly ironic situation, where there were people based out of Afghanistan going into the Fatah region carrying out attacks. And so if it's true, like obviously the claim would have to be, if they were willing to make the claim, the Pakistani government would have to be claiming unwilling, unable, which is a little bit rich, considering some of the objections that they were lodged over time.
Pluska change, my friend. Pluska change.
Pluska change.
By the way, have you seen that while we're sort of tying threads loosely together, have you seen that the new season of Serial is about Guantanamo?
I did not know that. You startle me, sir.
So Serial, the podcast.
Are they taking up some particular person's circumstances, or is it sort of some bold, I guess is the word, attempt at a retrospective?
So they're telling story. I mean, at least so far, I think only two episodes have only, I think the first two episodes have dropped, but so far they're telling stories through individual people. So episode one was basically, through the perspective of one particular guy who served at Guantanamo for a while and who was contrasting the experience of serving at Guantanamo with actually serving in forward combat zones in Afghanistan and Iraq. And then the second episode was from the perspective of one detainee.
So I will, of course, listen to this, and I will definitely be watching to see how much nuance do they bring to bear? Because I think it's fair to say that whatever one, if you look at the sum population of what was the total over time, 770 something detainees?
At its highest, it was in the 770s.
Yeah, I guess there's the lifetime total question. I'm not sure if you had 770 something at once, the lifetime total would be different. In any event, there is a finite number, but it's a large number, and that number contains multitudes, figuratively and literally. It'll be interesting to see if in Serial they take a framing that emphasizes the cases that seem most likely to be, mistakes of fact on the U.S. government's part.
I mean,
or if they include some that are, there are plenty of people who've been there that by their own account were senior Taliban figures or key people.
I had some involvement in this. I did a lot of fact checking for them. So much so that if you listen all the way to the end of episode two, you'll hear them slightly mispronounce my name.
After all that work, there's your thanks, Mr. Vludek. Yeah,
it happens. But my experience both talking to them offline and listening to these two episodes so far is that there is not a lot of sermonizing in this show, that it's actually basically like, this is all a mess and here's how it came to be such a mess. And I think that is, objectively, I think that is undeniable, even if folks might disagree about how we apportion blame or just how, negative we think the behavior was on both sides that got us there. So
it seems like we may need to build this in as, we used to review Game of Thrones episodes. Maybe we need to be reviewing Serial episodes.
That would require, I think, more frequent episodes than we have lately been putting out, my friend.
I think at one point we falsely claimed we were going to watch like one or another of the new Star Trek series. And
Picard, I thought.
Yeah.
The new season of Picard.
By the way, I've been watching Strange New Worlds. It's incredible. Have you watched Strange New Worlds?
I have not. Okay, here's how behind I am on watching stuff, okay? There is a new series on Apple TV about the assassination of President Lincoln. I have not started it.
Okay, yeah, that's shocking. You're on the plane all the time. Do you work on the plane? Yes. What's your habit on the plane?
Work.
That's the problem.
Work, and email. My inbox, your inbox must be insane too, but my inbox is just like, because various of the thing, it's not just like, there's stuff I'm committed to, there's work stuff, there's, you know, student queries, which always come first. But also, I mean, you know, we're going to talk about the sort of the Texas immigration stuff in a minute. Like, I have unfortunately found myself at the intersection of a lot of the discussion of the Texas immigration law stuff because it's implicated a bunch of overlapping areas of my own work.
I would imagine that your inbox is actually worse than mine because mine's, the daily flow is massive and some of it's like really important, has to be attended to and time consuming. But a lot of it is more informational. And anyways, I think it's a safe bet that you probably get just invitations to speak, like basically multiple times, probably every hour, if not every day.
I don't know, every hour. That's a little excessive.
Yeah.
But I would say I probably get like two invitations a day and somewhere between 5 and 10 media requests.
Right. And you can ignore it, and you probably by necessity you have to. But
I feel like, I mean, so this is the problem, is that I feel like it's rude, right? And so what I do is
AI. You need Copilot to be activated in your Outlook, and then you train it up to use Steve tone, lots of methinks and things like that.
Alas, indeed. But like, I mean, I keep all these emails in my inbox, Bobby, under the sort of illusion that I will find time to write back to all of them in due course and with appropriate, you know, sort of care.
Yeah, ain't gonna happen, unfortunately.
You know, our mutual friend Jack Goldsmith has a permanent out of office on his email.
I always think of him when I think about overburdened inboxes and just too many demands. And it's actually miraculous. And you can get emails from Jack like at 5 a.m.
Oh yeah,
because he's much more conscientious than I am, and he's actually devoting.
Jack is very conscientious.
Time to do that. Yeah. Okay, back to the show.
I think we had Russia-Ukraine, I think, was next.
Ukraine, yeah. I mean, gosh, what's there to say?
We should be funding it.
Yeah.
Like, we should be funding
it. Hard concur on that. Major national security law developments that's sort of out of the ordinary compared to where we were before our last episode?
Just, you know, certain members of Congress holding up funding for Ukraine on...
Yeah, but that's politics. I mean, I don't think there's any...
Yeah, but that's politics coming from the Party of National Security. Okay.
Well, I don't think the party alignments on some of these issues are quite what they used to be. Well,
on that we can agree.
Yeah. We certainly agree that they should be funded, and it's absolutely in America's national interest to support Ukraine. And it's more than disappointing. It's a problem that ain't happening, but none of that's legal analysis, but you get what you pay for on this show.
It's going to be a really big problem depending upon what happens in November.
Correct.
So,
speaking of things that may or not happen, let's talk about both Section 702 renewal and the TikTok ban. I pair them together because in both cases, got bills. What are these bills coming forward?
I've got bills. They're multiplying.
Oh, show title. Hold on.
I don't know. Something about 100 days, I think. Maybe
okay, I'll still write that down though.
I've got bills. They're multiplying.
Somebody out there is a law student who's involved in their annual parody show. And if y'all
who was too young to get that reference, Bobby.
That way everybody knows songs from Greece.
I think our really devoted listeners know that when you and I first cooked up the scheme for this podcast, we were gonna use the title song Greece as our intro music.
The opening blast, it opens with the crescendo and then spills down into the riff. It's so perfect. And then we were like, I wonder what was it cost to use that? Oh. Okay, now let's go. Let's have somebody make something. All right. So TikTok, obviously, there's legislation that's passed the House that seems to be kind of languishing for the moment in the Senate that would set a deadline by which, by a certain time, ByteDance, Chinese headquartered company, would have to divest itself of TikTok, the American operation. Have to sell it off, or else at that point, if it's not sold off, then it gets banned in effect. And there's little doubt, I think, that ByteDance, not only whether they want to or not, that there's little doubt from what the Chinese government officials have said, like ByteDance is not going to be allowed to do this. I think that's pretty clear. Now, what happens when the ban then comes to effect, if the Senate passes and then if the president signs, though he seemed to indicate that he would sign it.
Do you think the Senate will pass it?
I have no idea. I don't at all know how to do the whip count on that for the Senate in today's politics. It seems like there's generally bipartisan enthusiasm to be seen to be, quote, tough on China. Whether this is or not is sort of a tricky question. I think that it's simultaneously true both that there's overhyping of the threat because people really can really lean into it, but also that there is something very important and real about both the potential under China's national security laws to compel ByteDance to access or ensure access to U.S. person information. Like, that's not made up. It's certainly the case that if you're a Chinese headquartered company, no matter your good intentions, if the Ministry of State Security demands your cooperation, you both absolutely have to give it in whatever it is, whatever capacity needs to be given. And they can put in a gag order that will absolutely take effect. There being no free press to, you know, to go to with leaks about it. Other piece, the potential for algorithmic manipulation is, again, overhyped, yet also real. And so it's more a question of if this happens, which I think the politics might lend it to happening, would the TikTok entity, which goes to court at that point to bring a First Amendment challenge, other claims too, but a First Amendment challenge, would it cut ice? I suspect not, but I don't know if you have a strong view on this.
I think under existing First Amendment doctrine, there are decent arguments, Bobby, that this triggers at least intermediate scrutiny. And I don't know about the tailoring. I mean, I'm sympathetic to like trying to limit the pervasive influence of TikTok because of the extent to which it's a national security threat. I don't know. Part of me thinks we're better off without the statute passing, because if the statute passes, it might screw up First Amendment law.
Interesting. You see a possible successor to Humanitarian Law Project and the material.
I don't know. Humanitarian Law Project. You know,
which that's strict scrutiny, by the way, and the government's
right,
still
where the court, I think, you know, sort of fudged the strict scrutiny analysis a bit to uphold a statute that, you know, I understand why folks are worried about TikTok. I think those concerns are legitimate. I just worry about sort of, you know, what it would say if we, you know, sort of going all the way in the other extreme. I mean, we've already seen, you know, the Texas state government has banned state employees like us, right, from having TikTok on our work devices, from using it at work. I don't know. I guess I'm wondering if there's a less restrictive way to do this.
So it's interesting to frame it through the lens of tailoring, whether it's intermediate with its relative flexibility or strict with its theoretically less or lack of flexibility on the point.
Least
restrictive alternative analysis. I think here it would, if it comes to this in litigation, the existence of this incredibly protracted, CFIUS review process going back to the Trump administration,
yeah,
and all kinds of remember there was like the whole Oracle thing. They've yep. tried so many different ways to find a way to make this work,
yep,
and haven't done it. So I think that ultimately that record ends up weighing really heavily in the tailoring analysis. Of course, the magnitude of the government interest will be given its due weight. So I suspect that's why I think that even with strict scrutiny, but certainly with intermediate, I think the government ends up winning if it comes through. But it doesn't seem to have any particular momentum in the Senate, kind of like 702 renewal. Okay, what? First of all, where are we with 702? Where's the deadline now?
I honestly don't remember.
Okay, so it was April 19th, right?
That's the last time I saw, right?
Yeah.
In December, they kicked it to April 19th.
Checking my watch. This isn't very far off.
That's 18 days from now.
This seems like a problem.
Well, and especially because I, you know, somewhere in the news, I seem to have recalled a statement from Speaker Johnson that he actually, that he didn't want 702 reauthorization to get tacked on to something, that he actually wanted to have a clean bill, you know, to sort of to hash it out.
Well, he's got a lot of distractions at the moment, his own problems.
What you mean the fact that his majority is shrinking and he might not be speaker for much longer?
Well, is anyone speaker for long these days?
Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, well, the since then it's been a quicker door to revolve.
But I mean, listen, without asking you to sort of approve any of the underlying conduct, doesn't it say a little bit about her leadership skills that she was able to maintain party unity in a time when the Republicans have just not been able to?
I have no idea how hard it was to assemble control over the Democratic majority during that long period. It's certainly an apples to oranges situation in that, I mean, have we ever had anything quite like the current state of the GOP? There's two parties lurking underneath that that label, right? And this is one of the stories of our time. It's not one party right now. There's a battle going on for the soul of the GOP. And the speaker situation clearly reflects that. But back to 702. So I think it's inconceivable they would just let it expire. The national security cost to that is quite substantial. And one imagines that it's still the case. One hopes it's still the case that cooler heads could prevail and at least kick this down the road until somebody finally decides, okay, we're ready to really wrestle with what are the set of reasonable additional reforms associated with federal surveillance law that could be adopted as part of a larger package to put this, put the underlying capability, which the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board has repeatedly said, this is really important. This isn't like the old Section 215 metadata capability, which there were lots of doubts about just how useful it was. People who I trust who were really engaged on this in detail seem to all agree on, you know, both the Republican appointed and Democratic appointed members of PCLOB seem to all agree like this is very valuable. There should be reforms. They disagree about what those reforms ought to be. They don't seem to question the underlying authority. And you just wonder, maybe our politics is so broken that it's kind of like, remember DOD sequestration, financial impacts on Pentagon budgets. Yep. They were so draconian that, of course, they would force action, and then until it didn't, and there just were these draconian impacts.
Boy,
I wish there was a way to spell that sound, because once an episode, at least, we get that sound, and it would make for a great.
I mean, these days it's like it's just like all the time, Bobby.
I know. Well, I don't know if this will make you happy or not, but shall we pivot to Trump litigation?
Sure. By the way, while I've been sitting here, the Tigers have scored 5 runs in the top of the 10th.
Of course they did.
but just in case you were wondering how they did it, so let me summarize how the inning has gone. A fielding error by the second baseman.
Okay.
A ground ball to the pitcher that should have been a double play that the pitcher deflected rather than fielded cleanly and was somehow scored a single.
Sounds like Bad News Bears.
Yep. A sacrifice fly, and a 3-run homer.
Wheels coming off.
So
a season of futility on the horizon. See, maybe this is actually kinder and gentler than the usual thing where they keep us start to believe.
I think the Mets haven't been 0-4 since 2005. Is that possible?
I mean, do you think, I mean, let me be the optimist that is my role. 4 out of so many games, the sample's too small. This doesn't tell us anything. Rough start.
Well, so listen, I mean, it doesn't guarantee anything. I think the ways the Mets have lost these games are unfortunately potentially symptomatic of broader problems that are going to lend themselves to a very unsuccessful season.
The pitching's not looking super exciting.
The hitting or the fielding.
But how's the food?
Even the uniforms are bad. Have you seen all the problems with the new Major League Baseball uniforms?
Yeah. Look, in addition to having a role on the show as an optimist, I'm also a traditionalist. And I love the, you know, they should just wear the 1986 uniforms. Real simple.
Bobby, not the Mets uniforms. Across the majors, there are problems with these new, you know, Fanatics uniforms. Like the, you know, they're see-through and the letters are too small. And it's just, it's all kind of drama.
Yeah. I'm sure very smart marketing people really know what they're doing in terms of generating more sales.
Really? That's your theory is that these are very smart people and not just people who don't care.
Oh, do you not read sarcasm into my favorite?
It's too late for sarcasm.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. This point in the show, your tolerance for laughing in the face of difficult things is much eroded. I recognize.
Speaking of which, let's talk about the Supreme Court.
Okay, so do you want to go through the lens of SCOTUS, or you want to come up through the lens of various Trump litigations? I don't think we can possibly do remote justice to everything. Do you want to pick a few?
Why don't we do the status of the four criminal cases, and we can hit SCOTUS as we go.
Okay, that seems like the key thing from a national security perspective. Yes. And I certainly agree that, you know, at a fundamental baseline level, the stability of the political order and the absence or presence of violence and unrest in politics, these are core national security issues. Historically, Americans in recent decades haven't thought a lot about, but these days we do. So this is all in scope for the show. What's happening?
Not much. In the Florida classified documents case, Judge Cannon is slowly moving toward trial, but is also like keeps handing down these pretrial orders that really, Bobby, are hard to reconcile with a judge who's actually trying to, you know, move proceedings along in a sort of even-handed way. You know, orders relating to potential jury instructions, orders relating to SIPA procedures under the Classified Information Procedures Act. I mean, there's just this should have been, I mean, I continue to think that the classified documents case is the most open and shut of the cases where Trump's culpability is just, you know, both one, you know, latent on the face of the allegations, and two, not complicated by any questions of presidential immunity since he wasn't in office at the time that he completed the offenses. But Judge Cannon seems to view things differently.
Well, did you read David Lett's reporting about her
the clerks
challenges in the
so
the
I yeah thing? I
let me for as for as as, what as we're talking about kind as of with, real
yeah,
quick
yeah.
David reported about turnover. It's complicated. I'm not going to go into details. A lot of turnover in the chambers, difficulties with, you know, a clerk getting clearances, and they kind of, I think it's fair to say the general thrust was part of what's going on here is an extremely stressed out situation leading to some just sort of basic office dynamics that are adding to the slowness, gumming up the works. And I don't think he was saying it was I didn't read him to be saying this is all that's going on. It's slow because the chambers are kind of blowing up under the pressure of it all. But rather that is certainly part of the story and maybe making some things look worse than they are from the point of view you were just expressing.
So I don't know if you've read David's updates, of which I think there are now 17 to that particular post.
I think I read one, so I'm almost afraid to ask.
I've known David for a very long time, and I think he does a lot of really good work, but I also think sometimes he gets distracted by gossip. And I think that may not have served his reporting well in this case. One of the clerks who left, Bobby, left because she had a baby.
Right.
Both of the vacancies were filled quickly, and Judge Cannon has not apparently actually had a long period of time where she was understaffed.
I don't think my read of the story had all that, but it was basically saying that nonetheless, the turnover, which doesn't come without, you know, administrative cost and the inability of at least one clerk to get a clearance left for a long stretch, there was just one clerk working on the stuff. And so I took him to be saying, look, part of what's going on, not all, but part of what's going on is they're just overwhelmed and they're making mistakes and it's getting slower. But
I mean,
you're not buying it. You're not buying it.
I don't think that's causal. Two, I think Judge Cannon was doing ridiculous things before any of this started happening inside her chambers. I think there's larger issues here that wouldn't be solved even by a fully functioning chambers.
Do you feel comfortable trying to talk a little bit about, so the jury instruction order, the hypothetical that sort of, I'm not sure I'm really prepared to try to lay out the nuances of this, but I know that was very interesting. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I mean, I think to do it justice would take longer than we really want to, to go down the road. I mean, there's a really good piece by Roger Parloff on Lawfare that really sort of takes us up in detail.
I agree. Roger kind of laid it out really well also in a podcast episode with Ben and Quinta and everybody else on Lawfare podcast. So we could just refer people to that. I think it makes a strong case that there, I think that the squirreliest substantive thing happening is the suggestion that there's certain possible defenses available that could get written into the instructions that just shouldn't.
Right. Right. So, I mean, we'll see what happens. Suffice to say, like whatever one thinks of what Cannon's doing, in the short term, the consequences are that this case, which should have been the easiest and the fastest, shows no sign of going to trial anytime soon.
Right. And of course, this is where the election, for all the federal cases, the election looms dominantly on the horizon. If Trump were to win, do you think there's any doubt that he would pardon himself across the board on the federal case?
No, which takes care of this case and the January 6th prosecution in D.C.
Right. So this leaves state-level action, which I think, as we've said many times on the show, just to be clear, the president's pardon power unquestionably does not enable a president to exonerate themselves from state charges, separate sovereigns in that respect.
Yeah, so, although I do worry about a Supreme Court. I mean, if Trump is convicted in one of these state cases and his appeal is still pending when he becomes president, I do wonder about whether the Supreme Court would find some kind of problem, right, with sort of a state being able to impose a criminal sentence against the sitting president of the United States.
I can easily imagine some, I can totally imagine, as you say, a tolling of the proceedings.
Right, something like what Justice Breyer argued for in the civil context in Clinton versus Jones.
100%. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see that. That's some high stakes poker right there if it comes to it.
It's all so depressing. All right. So really quickly, the Georgia case got sort of sidetracked for a bit by the Fani Willis sort of affair allegations and all of that mishigas. It seems to be back on track now and moving slowly toward potentially a trial. The case that looks like it really is going to trial first is the New York fraud prosecution. There's been a lot of movement on that. There's been, discussions of gag orders and other sort of, getting ready for the trial to begin. There was an evidentiary fight between the Southern District U.S. Attorney's Office that's since been resolved. So, Bobby, I think by the end of the month, we might see at least the beginning of a trial in the New York fraud case. But, and then that brings us back to the January 6th prosecution, which is currently on hold because the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear oral argument on April 25th on Trump's, to me, rather extraordinary claim that he's immune from criminal prosecution for, stuff he did, quote, as he was in his official capacity as president, unquote.
So I continue to think, and I won't beat a dead horse because I'm sure we totally agree on this, that the unquestionably the right answer is that there is no that argument's bogus. I don't think there's a majority for that on the court. There may be a vote or two, but I don't think there's a lot of vote for it.
I guess I'm a little worried about the court's behavior to this point. Yes, the court agreed to hear the case this term, but they didn't expedite it as much as they could. I don't know.
I think no more than two votes for Trump's argument, in my opinion.
Yeah, but I think there are probably more than two justices who are worried about a hypothetical not presented in this case. To me, Bobby, the real issue here is not immunity. The real issue is the old, OLC argument that Jack has been writing about a lot, about whether, criminal statutes of general applicability apply to the president. And so that's not about immunity in any sense of the term. It's about statutory interpretation and whether the Supreme Court is going to think that like general obstruction and conspiracy statutes do not in fact apply to the sitting president.
So the question is, should there be a clear statement, interpretive rule, that you better say the president? Of course, by that logic, I guess you have to say lots and lots of officials. You have to include all sorts of things.
I should say I'm no fan of the clear statement rule, but I think that insofar as more than one or two justices are going to be troubled at all by the issues in this case, I actually suspect it's going to be more about, you know, applying these very general criminal statutes to the president than it's going to be about immunity. I mean, the immunity question proves way too much, because it would mean, you know, I can shoot my rival, right?
Yeah, even the faintest acquaintance with the founding of the country would suggest that perhaps that's not how the design was meant to
right.
work.
But so, Bobby, imagine a different fact pattern where the president sends a cabinet member up to Congress to testify before Congress with instructions to lie, right? You know, is the president guilty of the crime of conspiring to obstruct an official proceeding?
I mean, by your hypothetical, yes. And the only question is, should we read into that particular statute this rule of interpretation? You know, by the same token, if we say the president sends the cabinet member out into the streets to murder that annoying guy who's always out there with the sign, I think it's...
I agree with you. I'm just telling you why I'm not as sort of sanguine about how this case is going to go.
But I think that the at most two votes for yes. Trump will go with the cover of the clear statement rule, because it sounds less ridiculous. But I think there's still only two votes for that. You know, if you really are drawn to the clear statement rule test, then you have to be able to articulate how it could be that the rule is you don't have to have a clear statement for this set of crimes, like murders and all sorts of things. But then there's this clear statement required for these other crimes, even though no one's ever talked about this before. As far as I know, is there a single thing in all of federal criminal law that mentions that says expressly that gives the clear statement? I mean, it would be a hell of an innovation.
Bobby, I agree with you about all of this, but it's not up to me.
That's good. That's all you got to say. I'm right.
but it's not up to us. So,
well, would that it were. We'd have to leave it that way.
While we're on the Supreme Court beat, should we say a word about what's been going on with the invasion? Those were scare quotes, by the way, folks who can't see me. That's happening here in Texas.
I think your tone got it across. So maybe we'll do a quick overview. Governor Abbott released a statement asserting that it was sort of a two-step move. So there's a political and symbolic and narrative dimension to this that uses some of this. And then there's the question of like, hey, like what's your legal claim if you're in court? What are you prepared to litigate? Just let me just focus, recognizing that I feel like the statement was released as a symbolic political narrative, not as like, here's our white paper legal analysis. But the symbolic statement was a two-step. Step one, under Article 4, Section 4, of the Constitution, which lists various duties.
The federal Constitution.
Yeah, the federal Constitution, yes. Listing various duties imposed on the newly created federal government, things it has to do for or on behalf of in relation to the various states. There's a clause in there about a duty to protect the states, quote, against invasion.
Right, and shall protect them against invasion.
Shall protect them against invasion. And then, separately, Article 1, Section 10, the enumeration of prohibition.
Of things states can't do.
The thou shalt not list for the state. Yeah. That was part. You know, to my mind, one of the most interesting parts of the original constitutional text is that in a document where most of the anxiety surrounded figuring out what powers to give to the federal government and the big thou shalt not list that came before there was a Bill of Rights, there's Section 9, which is the original Bill of Rights. It just never gets talked about that way. But then there's Section 10 that said,
"Hey, some of us talk about the suspension clause that way, sir."
True, exactly. Well, we're like-minded there. As long as we have the hood up on the car, the drafters also decided, well, we're going to go ahead and say a few things while we have the hood open about states not doing certain things. And one of those things is states, thou shalt not engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger of same as will not admit of delay. So invasion shows up in these two related concepts. I imagine, Steve, you and I both agree that the original intent here, and I would argue that the something very close to the plain text reading, both suggest this is about war powers. This is about the use of military force in the context of engaging in warfare. The states, having been independent sovereigns, having marshaled military force, having engaged in war, were being expressly disempowered from doing so, except in the event of war being brought to them, and they have no choice but to act. And so I don't think it's too tricky at all to say that you can have border crossings. Obviously, you can have border crossings that count as invasions. That's the whole point of this. In the easy case, the paradigm case would be an armed force or any kind of recognizable military entity. There's material from the founding that would suggest that a fair original understanding is that certain types of, say, piracy or other forms of violence, violent incursion from abroad, or things that displace your sovereign authority, seize territory, et cetera, that there's a dimension to this beyond just the armies of the United Kingdom coming across the border from Canada after the founding. But Steve, I don't think we've got any of that. We have a lot of entry into the country that's not supported by law. I don't think there's much of an argument that it's an invasion within the terms of either Article 1 or Article 4.
So, I mean,
you wouldn't disagree with that, would you?
No.
Okay, just checking.
But also, I don't think it's up to a state to decide that question. I mean, there's the other question here of who makes that determination. And one of the crazy things, Bobby, if you actually go back and do the, you know, the originalism, which I did. So there was a very similar provision to what's Article 1, Section 10 in the U.S. Constitution in the Articles of Confederation.
Yeah. No, it was clearly carried forward.
But what's interesting about that, Bobby, right, is that the whole point of the Constitution vis-a-vis the Articles of Confederation was to expand federal military power, not to contract it, right? And what's interesting is that the Articles of Confederation provision, right, specifically referred to a danger so imminent as not to admit of a delay till Congress can be assembled. Right, so that was Article 6, the Articles. So in other words, right, it's clear from the Articles of Confederation that this was not a substantive. Like, it wasn't like the states could defend themselves if they just happened to disagree with how the federal government was or how the Confederation government was responding to the invasion. It was simply a stopgap, reflecting the rather obvious fact that in 1781, you know, the what passed for a centralized military was not necessarily, you know, able to respond quickly.
So I don't know that I disagree with any of that. To me, I think it's useful to bring the prize cases to bear here, because as soon as we raise,
it's always useful to bring the prize cases to bear.
I know I'm such a broken record, but I do love talking about it, and it's very useful here. So prize cases, Civil War decisions, Supreme Court basically says though there's no declaration of war. An international law relevant and therefore admiralty law relevant and therefore prize cases relevant state of armed conflict legitimately exists despite the lack of a formal declaration at the time the ships were seized or thereafter for that matter, because the necessity of war had been brought upon the Union, according to the way the court framed it, that the president was not just entitled to recognize that a self-defense scenario had arisen, but indeed was compelled to do so and had a duty use force. So it's all about, like, in the case of attack, the United States as a federal separation of powers matter, the executive branch has the power to act. And you can look at Article 1, Section 10 sort of through that same lens that, look, in the event of an attack, especially in ye olden times, where what there is of the U.S. Army is very remote and probably committed in the Northwest Territories.
All 780 soldiers, Bobby.
Right, and so if Spanish forces or whatever came up from Florida, or, you know, depending on the time period we're talking about.
Aaron Burr.
Exactly. Where's that Governor Wilkinson?
General Wilkinson.
General. He was a governor too, wasn't he? Or was he just the general? Yeah, I don't remember. The states acting in their military capacities with the state militias could, of course, use force and engage in warfare. Yeah. So in the prize cases, the less studied part of it, but a part you and I both know well, there is language in which the court said, basically, by the way, this is Lincoln's call to make on the federal separation of powers issue, and sort of necessity. And it reads as a real draconian, like there's no second guessing this. If the president says America's been attacked, off to the races without a declaration of war. Every year, I taught this for 20 straight years, and every time I would put up a goofy slide with Canadian Mounties and on parade, and I'd say, okay, so imagine that the president claims that these guys are going to invade upstate New York, and it's just not true. Do you think like, oh, well, that's too bad. The price case is said. The president gets to make the call. And of course, if you make it farcical enough, people acknowledge that there's got to be a limit. There's got to be sort of a de minimis rationality. There's got to be sort of an outer boundary that the courts might be willing to enforce. Doesn't have to be, but it certainly stands to reason that maybe in the prize cases, the court didn't really mean to say like, come hell or high water, no matter how obviously made up and insane the claim is, you could read into it that little asterisk. And so the question, I guess, here is there anything, if you buy that analysis, which is certainly how I read the prize cases, is there something to it here, some notion that, you know, the governors can make this call, but not if it's ridiculous.
No. I mean, just like, no.
That's a much stronger reaction than I was expecting you to have to the proposition that let me make sure, because I worry from the strength of your reaction, you're misunderstanding my hypothetical.
No. I'm not.
There's like, a real cross-border invasion.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Yeah.
Let's say Congress is in turmoil. The speaker's been overthrown. The president is incapacitated. Who knows what? Just all kinds of craziness. Just hypothesize. There is no federal action right away. But, and of course,
then at that point, the governors may not be acting consistently with the Constitution. But who cares? I mean, like
would it be easier to say like the Article 1, Section 10 contemplates that. Literally contemplates in the event of an invasion, if Congress hasn't and the president hasn't contrarily acted,
yes,
that there's a residuum of authority to use the Texas National Guard.
Okay, I'm sorry. If that is the claim, if the claim is, right, in a circumstance in which the federal government, in a conjured hypothetical,
yes,
in which there's some invasion where the state is able to act before the federal government is, and I'm hard-pressed to believe how that would ever be real. Right,
know, but look, this
fine
this typical classroom stuff. We once
okay, but, okay, but so let's be clear. Let's be clear about what Texas is arguing. Texas is not arguing that it has residual authority. Texas is saying they're not doing enough. We disagree with them
all the time. Begin baby steps in the argument by setting forth the clear concepts and then working to the middle, so it's clear where the lines are. That's all we're doing here. So I wouldn't represent in any way that's the state of affairs. But there obviously is some residuum of authority. So then the question becomes, okay, so what's wrong about what's going on here? And let me preface it by asking, is it actually a category mistake to be talking about this at all? Is what the state of Texas is doing with the Texas National Guard engaging in war at all?
So, I mean, I've made the point that the answer is no.
Right. I think that's a huge part of the debate. I agree with you on that.
But that's a separate argument from the argument Texas. I mean, so yes. So to me, there are three responses to Texas's argument, right? Response number one is this is not an invasion, which, oh, by the way, everything ends there. Response number two is even if it's an invasion, parentheses, it isn't. Right, the federal government is there. You just don't like what they're doing, and that is not, by any plausible reading, the residual authority that Article 1, Section 10 leaves to the state. And then problem number three is, and even if it was, you're not actually doing the thing that the Constitution lets you do in those cases. Right.
This is where I want to get. I think we agree on this, that in some senses, the invasion war powers discussion is a red herring.
I don't think it's a red herring.
You don't? Well, I thought you just did say that.
Hold on a second. I don't think this case rises and falls. Like, I don't think this case does or should rise and fall on the notion that immigration enforcement is not, quote, engaging in war, unquote. I think that's much mushier than the far more straightforward points that, one, this is not an invasion, and two, the federal government has responded to the influx of unauthorized migration at the border. Texas just doesn't like how it's responded.
So I don't think, it sounds like you think we disagree, but I don't think we do. To me, what I'm trying to get at is the point that this isn't about, it's not invasion, not in the constitutional sense. I think that's the originalist and textualist correct answer, and much else besides. What's really at stake here and where it's more interesting is, okay, so it's almost like a preemption discussion. And in here, the state is asserting authorities to do things down the border in the name of enforcing the sanctity of the border that one, maybe conflict with federal immigration law. Two, maybe there's a degree of field preemption or categorical exclusion of the states. And that's where I think the conversation ought to be. So can you talk to the listeners about what's the right way to conceptualize? Clearly, the federal government clearly has authority to act in relation to the border. There's no good argument that it doesn't. No one's claiming otherwise.
Well,
how does that then cast a shadow over what, if anything, states can do? Because it probably doesn't mean states can't do anything. What's your position on that?
I mean, it's not my position. It's the Supreme Court's position. But, you know, just to be clear. I mean, so listen, at the founding, the states actually had a decent amount of authority over immigration because Congress had not acted aggressively to create this comprehensive nationwide scheme. But, you know, for the better part of 150 years, the Supreme Court has said that federal regulation in the field of immigration not is exclusive, Bobby, but is certainly incredibly broad and entitled to preemptive effect.
One might even say plenary.
Of course, that was in reference to the rights of the immigrants, not of the states.
I know. Okay.
So, I mean, listen, the huge case here, which folks should go and read for themselves, I've also written about this for the newsletter, is a 2012 decision by the Supreme Court in a case called Arizona versus United States. That was about Arizona's SB 1070. SB 1070, Arizona styled as an effort to supplement federal immigration enforcement by creating a series of state-level crimes, where the crimes were basically just the act of being out of status with regard to federal immigration policy. And in Arizona, a 5-3 court struck down most of SB 1070. I just conflated the two. Struck down most of SB 1070 on the ground that it was preempted by various policy choices Congress had made in the relevant statutes, and Bobby, Congress had delegated to the executive branch of the federal government to make in the relevant statutes. What I think is worth stressing is two things. First, SB 4, the new Texas bill, goes much further than SB 1070 ever did. SB 4 does not just create parallel state-level criminal offenses. SB 4 creates a state-level deportation system where, you know, local magistrates are empowered to enter civil orders that are de facto deportation orders, and that require Texas officials to transport those subject to them to the nearest port of entry, at which point, who knows what. So right there, that's an even sharper conflict. There are parts of SB 4, Bobby, that make it a crime under Texas law to be in Texas, even if you actually can't be deported under federal law, if you entered the country without authorization but are nevertheless in a federal status that protects you from removal, you're still subject to arrest and prosecution under SB 4. Not sure how that's not a direct conflict with federal immigration law. And what's remarkable about Texas's litigating position is that Governor Abbott has said publicly, repeatedly, as recently as last week, that SB 4 is modeled on, quote, Justice Scalia's dissent in the Arizona case.
This is all why I wanted to talk about the preemption lens more so than the invasion lens, where I think a lot of the action is. And as you say, and you came right to the key point, it feels like what's going on here is a bid for a different interpretation. What do you think the chances are that they're going to win on that? Do you think there's votes for that?
No.
No? Okay, so.
Wait, sorry, on the preemption argument.
Yeah. So if you're very sure they'll stick with Arizona?
So, I mean, let's talk. So there are two different things.
You seemed less sure about the Trump thing a while ago. So I thought maybe you'd also think maybe there's going to be change here.
I don't. So I think there are two problems. The first is, let's just do a little bit of handicapping, right? So I said it was 5-3 in Arizona. one of the five was Chief Justice Roberts. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he has softened on this. So, you know, going in, right, Texas needs to sweep the other five Republican appointees. And I think in this respect, this is why it's a really big deal that SB 4 goes so much further than SB 1070. I think it's
makes possible. It easier, right? Makes it easier for people to say, well, you know, there might be some complexities, but this goes too far.
Right. I mean, like you could think Arizona was wrongly decided, Bobby, and still think SB 4 is preempted.
Exactly. Right. So and, it makes it, if they were really going for more of a strategic push to achieve a change in the law, the smart play would have been a what was the original Arizona bill?
SB 1070.
An SB 1070 minus 5, right? Like take it down a little notch, create a little space, and then
SB 1065.
Yeah, I guess that would be the mathematical result. Okay, so part of it I think was leading to a little confusion between us there, or a little crosstalk.
Sorry.
What? No, it's all good.
I get fired up.
That's why we talk it all through. SB 4 is one thing, but then there's Operation Lone Star, and there's enforcement activities on the ground. And so there's actions as opposed to creating legislation. And do you think there's maybe a little more elbow room, even if you're not persuaded, but maybe a little more elbow room for the state to take on these, what you might describe as self-appointed border control functions as a preemption matter?
No,
engaging in wars.
So, I mean, but that's not what it's doing. I mean, Operation Lone Star in practice, right, is Texas officials using existing legal authorities to arrest or deter unlawful or unauthorized crossings by migrants, right? And so, you know, arresting folks for criminal trespass, right? Or, you know, closing off particular parks or things like, right?
Yeah.
Those don't raise preemption issues because those aren't immigration authorities, right? That's Texas using sort of ordinary civil and criminal authorities in a way that has immigration effects.
So if I'm interpreting this right, and this is kind of where I thought you would go, it's a different analysis. If we break out the set of state immigration-related, migration-related, border-related activities, all of which kind of work together in the eyes of the public as just like this set of things that are being done, there's clear legal vulnerability on the state legislation innovations. The enforcement actions unrelated to SB 4, the various things you just listed, that's a different kettle of fish. And I don't think it's about invasion, engaging in war, or preemption.
Sort of. I mean, so the core part of Lone Star, no. But there are two other lawsuits between Texas and the federal government, Bobby. One is about Texas's placement of a movable barrier in the middle of the Rio Grande. One about the United States' removal of razor wire that Texas has placed along the U.S.-Mexico border.
So the former prevents some real clear problems under federal statutes about navigable waters. That's from a sort of legal framework, abstract perspective, a somewhat straightforward, non-constitutional.
I mean, you say somewhat straightforward, and I wonder if you have met the Fifth Circuit. I mean, you know, to this point, the Fifth Circuit has managed to not make that case very straightforward.
On the razor wire one, I'm much less up to speed on what's going on there. Do you?
So the razor wire case is actually a lawsuit by Texas against the federal government, claiming that the federal government was committing a tort when it removed the razor wire from along the Texas-Mexico border.
Can you sue the federal government?
Right. There's a pesky little problem called federal sovereign immunity, which is what led the district court. Chief Judge Moses, I think, had the razor wire case. So the district court dismissed the lawsuit on the ground of sovereign immunity. Texas is appealing, and the Fifth Circuit issued an injunction pending appeal.
Is the theory that, you know, is this an FTCA claim? I really don't know. What is the theory of why it's not subject to federal sovereign immunity?
I mean, you know, that there's sort of
a waiver claim?
That there are waivers that, you know, that Texas isn't bound by some of the limits, but also, Bobby, that it's an invasion. And so therefore, I mean, like the invasion stuff is lurking in all of these cases.
And I get it. And that's why I think it's good that we started with the discussion about the text, the original understanding surrounding the invasion clauses. I don't think there's too much serious question that those clauses contemplate a relatively conventional understanding, a militarized
understanding. I agree. I agree. And I think the U.S. Supreme Court, if and when the time comes, which will be probably next term, will agree. I just think that the razor wire case is a good example. So I mentioned the injunction pending appeal that the Fifth Circuit entered. So Bobby, back in January, since we last recorded, the Supreme Court, in an unsigned, unexplained order, where have I heard that before, vacated the Fifth Circuit's injunction pending appeal by a 5-4 vote. This, what I was struck by was how quickly a number of folks here in Texas, including, I think most prominently, Congressman Chip Roy, called on Governor Abbott to defy the Supreme Court's decision in that case. That was especially ironic because actually there was nothing to defy, right? Putting up more razor wire was not defying the vacatur of the injunction. But what worries me, Bobby, is not just how these legal arguments are being deployed. What worries me is that the rhetoric around immigration has become so toxic that even when this Supreme Court, you know, sides with the federal government on a technical, procedural, interlocutory ruling, there are, you know, very visible, highly respected politicians here in Texas saying, you know, F that. And I think that goes beyond just sort of the specifics of who's right and wrong about these constitutional arguments.
Well, this gets into the larger, long-term question of the connectivity between the most exigent political pressures of a given era and when the court is engaging in ways that, or any courts are engaging in ways that touch on those issues. Right now, you know, all the polls show for the Republican primaries, it wasn't school choice. It was the top issues, border, as many a observer has noted. And that certainly is ample to explain why you're seeing so much elected official attention and pushback. That's an old story, but we're in an interesting and somewhat scary new chapter on how courts operate in that context. And that's why this show we're going to continue to have a lot to talk about. I realize we've gone over the hour 20 mark. It's like we're trying to make up for the entire lost period, the lost tapes. Steve, are there lost tapes where we actually recorded a bunch of shows and then had to bury them because they were so crazy, things that were
so incendiary. We said so many ridiculous things.
The lost.
It's like Spaceballs 3, the search for Spaceballs 2.
If you play our shows backwards, what will you hear? My favorite is if you play it slow, where everybody sounds super drunk.
What are you talking about?
Do you listen to podcasts on high speed, by the way? Like, I often will listen pretty high speed.
I sometimes do, but like, so I was on Strict Scrutiny last week talking about some of the Texas immigration stuff. It was the immigration stuff with Leah Littman and Kate Shaw. And I will say, I love Leah to death. I would never listen to Leah and me at high speed.
No, I would not recommend that. What's funny is if you're accustomed to listening to anybody at 1.5 or 175.
And you meet them.
If you roll back to one, it's like, oh my God, what's wrong with them?
Are they okay? Yeah. Well, yes, they're speaking at a normal speed. Maybe I just need to be at 0.75 and that's the right speed for me.
Awesome. All right.
I would say our frivolity would be about how good the Mets are, but they suck.
Okay, so we need some ideas.
Bobby, I was clerking. You and I, the last time the Mets started 0-4 was right after you and I first met.
Ah, interesting. Well, your departure is bringing about the bad season for the Mets. It's some kind of cosmic
closure. No, last season was pretty bad too, and I wasn't leaving.
It was anticipatory. It was the buildup. Oh my. All right.
That means
the cycle for the Mets can continue, and we'll build back towards a 1986 moment. Dead silence from Steve.
That is quite the optimism, my friend. That's my job. At least we have the Knicks. Well, you have the Spurs, but I have the Knicks.
The Knicks, please. Although I did enjoy the Spurs getting a rare win over the Knicks the other day. That was great.
Hey, yeah, but I mean, the Knicks are going to be no less than the 3 seed in the Eastern Conference playoffs. Like, that's pretty good.
The Spurs are going to have a lot of lottery balls in the hopper when the time comes. By the way, any early insights from you on who, if you were to win the lottery, who would you take with the first pick?
I feel like all of the top prospects are like these international players.
Yeah. Well, that would be a good thing for the Spurs. I'm interested because the Spurs both are going to have a shot at this again, and they kind of clearly need another top talent. So who do you put next to Wemby?
Is Michael Jordan still available?
Zach, you're going to put Zach Eddy in there, go for the Twin Towers?
Ooh, there you go. Although, I don't know, maybe...
I want the guy from NC State.
I was going to say the guy from NC State.
Oh, my God. I watched him the other night against Marquette. Unbelievable. I mean, yeah. That was like watching Shaq.
I will say, I got to watch a little bit of the LSU-Iowa women's game tonight.
I don't know what happened. Lay it on me.
So it was a really entertaining back and forth game. Iowa pulled away in the fourth quarter behind 41 points from Caitlin Clark.
Only 41.
Only 41. I hope we get an Iowa South Carolina final. I think that would be, I would really enjoy that.
That'd be the bomb.
I feel the same about soccer. Like, I feel like women's college basketball, Bobby, when you get the best, like the elite level, I almost find it more enjoyable to watch than men's college basketball because there's more like teamwork and passing and like strategy that goes into it than just more of the pure athleticism.
I like both sides and both those sports, but I am particularly fond of women's soccer. I think it's wonderful. But
women's professional or amazing. Elite women's basketball, elite women's soccer players. Like they are like they're the most athletic people in the world. But I still think that there's more of an emphasis on sort of building plays and
shots and plays because there's just less of the game above the rim.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I think that's probably right. That's right. And it's a great sign for the progress of that sport.
I mean, they're getting better ratings than the men's tournament.
Right. I know. It's pretty cool. I will say I won't name a name, but I have a relative who had heard all about Caitlin Clark, was super excited. And the other night watched all of a game and was very frustrated not to see Caitlin Clark. Why weren't they putting her in? It's because she wasn't in that game. It was not an Iowa game.
Interesting. Yes. Probably a little bit of a miscommunication there.
Yeah, you might need to make sure you know which team you're watching. All right. I think we probably better kill it here. We're heading towards an all-time record.
Are we going to have a second episode in April?
I suspect we will.
Okay.
It'll be in April 1st.
Wow, Bobby has softened. He's all the way down to I suspect we will. All right. Well, he is at Bobby Chesney. I am at Steve_Vladek. We are at NSL Podcast. It's been 100 days. I feel confident we will go less than 100 days before our next episode.
Totes.
We're back, baby. Just like the Al Nashiri trial, which a trial judge today said, you know, is totally going to happen in 2025.
You bet your bottom dollar. I'm so sure it'll happen in 2025.
Yeah,
Do we agree that ain't happening?
It is not happening. All right. Well, until then and thereafter, stay safe out there, everybody.
Adios.